I think one of the kind of fundamental things that's kind of easy to forget might be partly a kind of linguistic thing, yeah, in a way, but because we've got such a dualistic idea of body and mind in the Western tradition, you know, I think we tend to think of meditation as kind of mental exercise. And I think one of the fundamental things I'd like to emphasize is that meditation is something we very much do with the whole of our body, really. I think it's better thought of it, if you've got to think of it in a dualistic way, which obviously we should try and avoid. It's probably better to think of it as something you do with the body, some kind of mental gymnastics. This attempt at kind of restrain or pacify our mental activity doesn't, to me, seem on the whole very successful. Of course, it can be done by a kind of forced act of will, but this leads to kind of tension rather than relaxation. And I think it means our meditation remains on quite a kind of superficial level. Anyway, we'll be exploring this in more detail as the days go on. Today, we'll just do a short meditation, focusing on the kind of physicality of meditation, that kind of physical aspect. So get yourselves comfortable. We'll see what happens there. Maybe just beginning by being aware of any sounds around you. Without making any special effort, you know, just be naturally aware of the sound arising. I'm going to take our awareness down now into our legs and our buttocks, whatever part of your body is in contact with your seat. We're going to link this awareness to our natural breathing. As we breathe in, be aware of the legs and buttocks. As we breathe out, let's just be aware of our legs, buttocks, feet. Just noticing if your legs feel any different on the in-breath than they do on the out-breath. The face relaxed while you're doing it. We're aware of our legs as we breathe in. And we're aware of our legs as we breathe out. Just let the pelvis sort of drop down. Maybe drop down and just open a little. And release the hips a little bit. And just noticing what it feels like. The in breath and the out breath. Having the idea of just trusting the earth beneath you, support you. Sometimes on the in-breath, you can get a sense of kind of legs very gently kind of expanding slightly, kind of a bit fuller. You breathe in and then just releasing. Feeling that weight more fully the ground as you breathe out. This sort of rhythm, these two different ways of trying to relax in the leg. Just working with the idea of giving the weight of the legs fully to the ground. Releasing in the hip. And the pelvis to drop down. I like to imagine the pelvis kind of attracted to the center of the earth beneath me. Getting the lower body kind of involved with this breathing. The big bones of the leg. Dropping down. Muscles just softening and releasing. On the in-breath, on the out-breath, the allowing the body to emerge the earth underneath. If you can find how the pelvic floor breathes. Or just feel like not to hold on the lower body, but just release. As you let go in the lower body, you might notice a natural kind of lift in the torso, in the back, led by the crown. Keep the emphasis of the legs, but if you notice, you're certainly upper body sort of drift away upward. Yeah, upper body becoming quite light. The lower body becomes released downward. Try to stay interested in the legs and the feet there. Just letting go a little more. our tendency to hold on mentally is mirrored in our body. In particular, maintaining a kind of sense of self, a small self. Really always reflected in a certain amount of tension and holding in our legs. But for most of us, there's nearly always some letting go that can happen in the leg. Let the breath kind of work here. Hip joints there. Let's keep the posture stop trying to do anything. Just sit, breathing. think I'm going to hand over to Pedro Lilo, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. If you're like me, I'm still surfacing from the meditation.
Take your time.
So I will be taking my time. Transitions are important before and after meditations. So just taking your time. So we had planned to do some inquiry or question answers coming out of the meditation. Perhaps particularly what you noticed, what you experienced during that sit or other sits or during the session so far. But I am aware that if you went quite deeply into meditation, probably the last thing you want to do is talk. Anyway, let's give it a go, see if anyone has anything that they would like to share or explore or and if it feels a bit daunting to say anything in front of everybody else, you can always post it in the chat. And if you want to be anonymous, you could always post it privately to Panyanita and she can read it out and no one will know it's you. And just to say that the questions and answers or inquiry will be recorded. So if you wish to remain anonymous, you can blank your screen and rename yourself. We tried previously, like pausing, recording, unrecording, whatever, and it was a bit of a palaver. Also, we did on our first one, we just recorded the answers, but then that was a bit weird. So I think we're basically going to record the whole stuff, and if you don't want to be there, take responsibility by blanking your screen and renaming yourself. Which doesn't mean to say that you can't take part, because I said you could post anonymously to Pranyanita and she can read out questions and comments. So do we have an intrepid person willing to take the risk? And did any of you do any remembering, either in the morning session or subsequently? I found the session really interesting and going back to the Buddha and his motivations for originally meditating as well, and thinking back to my own earlier experiences when I started. But actually, when asked or invited to remember, I didn't at all. It was only in the group sharing just now when somebody else shared a memory that I had a very vivid memory of my childhood. of being up a tree. We had a willow tree in the family house in the garden, and that was my kind of sanctuary, my special place for time. I'd climb up the tree and I'd just stay up there, and I'd be quiet there, and I'd be looking out through the leaves and thinking no one could see me, and birds and squirrels might come quite close. I'd be really still, really quiet, and also sometimes I'd take a book up there to read, but, you know, and it was particularly special because the rest of the family life was fairly chaotic and quite, yeah, quite dysfunctional. So there was that moment of peace and relaxation and connecting with nature up the willow tree that I'd forgotten and I've just remembered. So thank you, Paramananda, and also thank you, Liz, whose own memory spot mine.
So I have a question from someone. So the question is how to stay with the pain, physical pain in my head when I meditate.
So say that again, you got a bit distorted.
How do I stay with the pain in my head when I meditate, physical pain?
In your head. Not sure that you should. I don't know why. I'm not perhaps to know a bit more about the nature of the pain, I think.
Could you post a bit more? I mean, I think it is interesting, the whole area of sitting with pain. I mean, if we have chronic pain, we don't really have any choice. And actually, you know, meditating can really help with our management of the pain. But the idea of turning towards something, including in your experience, even if it's pain, we don't necessarily always want to be just turning towards it, sitting with it as the sort of focus. I don't know. Anyway, is there any more about that in the chat?
Yeah, so it's from not sleeping enough, pain in the head.
Ah.
With a head, I mean, I'm still not quite sure. I think you're a bit more of a zombie atmosphere, maybe. Maybe you can have some of
life. I don't know. As someone who's had a lot of pain from headaches over the years, different kinds of headaches, migraines and other sorts, and I also have sleep apnea, and there was a whole period when that wasn't diagnosed and I wasn't getting much sleep and I was having all these oxygen deprivation headaches and things that I experienced like migraines, and actually I found I wasn't able to meditate, partly because of being in so much pain and also because of the emotional and energetic kind of effect of prolonged lack of sleep. So I think there are times when our physical states do get in the way of meditation and conditions. I mean, if it is through lack of sleep, is there anything that might help with that? I mean, just sometimes it's kind of addressing the actual conditions that are getting in the way rather than in the meditation that can help, I think. And there's something about being with whatever's there, you know, if we can. But sometimes we can't. And there are times when certainly I found it's not possible to be meditate, or I found it impossible to meditate, you know, like just after bereavement when I've been all over the place, you know, or at that time when I was having all the symptoms from the sleep apnea. You know. Sometimes with pain, if we broaden out our experience and pay attention to parts of our body that aren't in pain, that can help. sometimes actually turning towards it with curiosity and just seeing what's there and experiencing in terms of sensation moment by moment can be. I suppose it depends on the degree and the extremity of the pain and
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard about going into detail, but, you know, knowing the case in detail, because I think, as you said, Bernadette, you've got two basic options. You either kind of try and turn towards it or you broaden out around it. I mean, it's not uncommon for meditators to get headaches, actually. And I think when that's the case, I've got no idea. This case seems to be sort of lack of sleep, but I think that's normally caused by trying to, you know, kind of over willful, you know, trying to force something too much. I mean, in a very sort of crude sense, you could say there's too much kind of energy in the head, you know, it wants to come down, so paying more attention to the legs and trying to release and trying to make a kind of a imaginative connection with the ground, which is kind of released into the kind of the headaches. It seems to me, I mean, I don't know, you know, but it's very difficult to generalize, and you know, well, I can generalize, but I mean, I don't know how appropriate that is. I tend personally to think headaches are sort of too much energy in the system in a way. It's some kind of relief. And I would probably try and release it through the leg, you know, a bit like what we were just trying to do, actually. But, you know, and by that method, you're also taking attention away from the sense of the pain, you know, down into sensations in the leg, but hard, isn't it?
I don't think it's possible to generalize. I mean, even with myself, I can think of lots of different kinds of headaches I've had, you know, like sinus headaches, and I've had migraines, and I have some that have maybe been to do with something that I've eaten. I've had a reaction to, and some have been tension. You know, sometimes when I'm suppressing things like anger, that I experience a headache. So, and I'm thinking, like, homeopathically, there's hundreds of remedies for headache, and you have to describe the exact headache before they give you the right remedy.
Could you just say a little bit about when it's linked to anger?
Well, I think... again, it's something about suppressing and being willful and not allowing yourself to experience something, and it gets stored in the body and expressed sometimes through being a headache for me. I know there's times when I was feeling a lot of murderous rage, for instance, but I wasn't allowing myself to feel it. And then I would get these terrific migraine-like headaches. And then once I started actually being able to own and acknowledge and feel those feelings, however uncomfortable they were and however much it challenged my view of myself as this kind and caring, compassionate person, I didn't have the headaches in the same way. So I did see a very clear link between that. That was my experience. I'm not saying that everybody who's got a headache is... got a murderous rage underneath it, but at a certain period in my life that was true.
And the headache would have been caused by the attempt to repress that feeling. Is that what you're saying?
So that thing about being quite willful, so we can be willful in terms of trying not to experience something in our meditation and our lives, and we can also be willful in terms of trying to experience something, you know, wanting a particular outcome, wanting a particular emotional experience or mental state or something. And I think either of those can result in tension and pain in some ways, because everything is related. So whatever mental, emotional states we're in, that will get echoed in the body and held in the body. Whatever we're feeling physically will have an effect on our mental, emotional states. You know, whatever's happening in our lives, it's all conditioning factors in a way. So whatever does happen in our meditation is going to be conditioned. You know, some of it long-term conditions, some of it what's happening just now. Or it can be, you know, like you say, a lack of sleep. Just that can be one of the conditioning factors, yes.
So I've got another comment and a question. So somebody said that the drumming was amazing, like being in the womb, a strong connection to the deep tones. And somebody was enjoying the Amitabha mantra practice and would love to hear more about what Amitabha means to you both. Bodhira was talking about his connection to burning through craving yesterday, for example. So
I didn't catch that last bit. What was it?
Bodhila was talking about connection to burning through craving.
Actually, I was. Well, I said there was a connection with craving, but he is. Well, I could spend ages talking about Amitabha. I love Amitabha. He's one of these archetypal figures, and you've got all these different symbolisms and attached, you know, that you can think of or just allow to play in you. But, you know, he's very much associated with fire as his element. So there is that kind of burning. But he's also the Buddha of meditation, Buddha of compassion and love, really. All the Buddhas have got wisdoms. He's got the discriminating wisdom, which means he sees, apparently, he looks on every single person, every single thing, and sees the uniqueness of them. And it's also said that he looks on everyone with the eyes of a lover, because, you know, like when you're in love with someone, you see all the little details and all the things that you like about them, the quirks, whatever. If you imagine that Amitabha's doing that for you, that's kind of nice, isn't it? Yes.
That's very nice.
Yes, he's there with those eyes of love looking at you, seeing you as you really are, and not rejecting you, because sometimes we can't do that for ourselves. So it's quite nice to think that there might be a Buddha out there doing that for us, isn't it? There's lots of things that are interesting about him, but yeah, one of the things is that all the Buddhas transform a particular poison, and the poison he transforms is craving. And it's interesting, he doesn't do that by, you know, that we have to just give up the craving. But what he does is he sort of transforms it into sort of craving for sort of the more skillful or the more beautiful or the more true, kind of sort of a bit more on the lines of Shraddha and faith, I think. I can't remember the exact wording of it, but it's in a way, rather than, you know, craving for chocolate cake or sex or whatever else it is, not to say there's anything wrong with chocolate cake or sex, but they can be more sort of refined, sort of more different levels of craving, you know. And in a way, probably the fact that we're all here, there's some part of us on the sort of more existential or spiritual level that's craving something and leading us, keeping us on this journey, if you want to think it in terms of journey. And I guess that's part of what that is. I mean, faith is Shraddha in Buddhism is often seen as like where you place your heart, what is most meaningful, you know. And I think that's very much part of what Amitabha's about. Anyway, did you want to say anything about Amitabha?
Well, I mean, it's quite personal in a way. I mean, for me, I think it just comes down to love, really. This somehow that's related to fire, perhaps in a sense, but you know, not quite sure what else I can say with it. I think particularly in recent years, I started to feel that sort of necessity for this real. I've had in the past used the word ferocious, you know, more or less like you have to have a kind of ferocious love, you know, for yourself, but not not based in through the experience of being alive, you know, not based in some achievement or ambition or possession or anything like this, but just as I suppose that I mean it as a way, a sort of perception of the actual aliveness, because that's what's nearest to you, you know, that connection with life. Nearest connection or the most visceral connection you've got is your own body, really. And so it's something about that for me, it's something about having this kind of love for your embodied state, because that's an entry into a more universal love, you know. It's just it's something to do with, yeah. So for me, I think it has, I mean, sort of represents that visceral sense of aliveness, which allows you to feel connected to the world, you know. So when you have that, I think when you get that sort of feeling, then you then feel beloved by the world in a way, because this quality I'm talking about is not based on any kind of, not really personal in a funny sort of sense. You experience the universal nature of your own being, you know. And of course, that opens you up in a particular sort of way, you know. So it's more or less, kind of paradoxically, I think it gets easier the older you get, the more decrepit you get, you know, the more you're falling apart, because it gets less and less tied up with your kind of ego and sense of self, and you sort of mellow into just being alive, you know, what a remarkable thing it is, you know, to have this reflective consciousness that allows you to experience life, you know, in a quite a visceral way. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but that's kind of where I'm coming from with Amitabha, really. Because to me, it's very much tied up with this idea of accepting your conditioned nature, you know. Very much tied up with this idea that you can just keep accepting yourself. A bit like what we're trying to do with the legs, just as you can keep relaxing the legs and there's no real end to it. I don't think there's any real end to accepting yourself. You know? At some point, of course, the self bit starts to dissolve a bit more, you know, or loosen or soften. And you just think you're accepting reality, you know. I mean, yeah, I suppose it's that little fragment of reality that is viscerally accessible to you.
Though I would say that probably that sense of that loosening, that sense of ego and self as you get older and more decrepit is probably, if you're someone who's been practicing, because I can think of a number of older people where it seems like the ego gets even more
fixed. You can go either way, yeah. There's always that option. You can always go either way, can't you? Either go in, yeah. like the little people in the way of their life, aren't they? They're either going up or down. Mm. So, yeah. But anyway, I'm just trying to be encouraging for
yes.
Like the people that are getting on a bit, you know, that there is a lot, there's a lot there, really. You know, there's a lot to delight in, I think. Yeah, we have to keep moistening ourselves with practice. Yeah, otherwise, we might, as you say, go the other way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, there's a whole lot that's not really rational about my feelings for Amitabha, and I do love him, and I have loved him for many years, and felt in a relationship. And he was the first of the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that I felt a connection with, and that's gone on for years and years and years, even though there's been others since who's been there as a constant. And I think I also connected with him maybe because he was the Buddha of meditation, because for me, meditation has been a very strong part of my practice and my path. And I think it's quite interesting because he's got fire and transformation, and he's a solar figure, and normally solar figures are really out there. And he's got this sort of like internal thing about the meditation, and that being equally transformative, you know. I think that's interesting. Anyway. And actually, I like his mantra very much. The plain one. It's interesting because we will be doing mantra, and I think I'll probably talk a bit more about mantra at some point. But certainly in Tri Ratna, we tend to do either a plain chant mantra or more melodic mantras that are a little bit, for me, like, well, sometimes it can be more like devotional singing, and they're in lots of different parts and harmonies, and can be beautiful, can be a little bit not quite so beautiful, but they have a different kind of quality to them, you know. So I think the more melodic ones can sort of like, they're just on, we respond to sound and music, don't we, and it opens our hearts. But I think that the plain ones, they're much more visceral, they're much more, we feel it in the body, and there's something very primal about them, and I find much more powerful for me than that's more the spirit of the mantras when we do the plain ones, even though I do like some of the melodic ones, and we will be doing both. But you know, like we like Paramahansa did on Sunday night, like, well, more than 108, where you just do the same very plain one again and again and again, and you're feeling it in your body and the vibrations, and yeah, especially if it's collective and there's a lot of other people doing that alongside you, it can be very, very powerful, and it really frees up energy and gets you in a different kind of state, and very embodied practice as well. I think we don't often, well, I know Paramahansa does, but in wider Tri Ratna, often mantras do get much more placed as something you might do a little bit as an introduction to a meditation practice, or as something you include in a ritual, as something to make offerings to, and not seen as a practice in itself that's just as strong, just as powerful as a meditation practice, you know. Yes. Though it's interesting, because when I was on my 3-month ordination retreat, and before you get ordained, you're kind of invited to sort of choose an archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva that you feel a particular connection with. And for many years I had two, one of which was Amitabha, one of which Akshobhya, who they complemented each other, and they've been very strong in my life. And I was thinking, who will it be, how can I choose one and not the other? And actually it was fine, it was very clear to me it was going to be Akshobhya. But then I thought, well, actually, Amitabha's not going to mind. It's no skill of his nose if I don't choose him. And actually, he's still in my life, and he'll still be there for me. And he has been. Yeah. So I don't know why I said all of that, but there you go.
Maybe I'll just say, I think one of the real possibilities within mantra chanting. In that, you know, when we chant in that plain sort of way, it's quite interesting that Amitabha seems particularly good for it, because it is, for me, a lot of it is it's a way into learning how to use effort in meditation. And I say it's quite interesting that Amitabha seems particularly useful, because effort in some traditions would be very much associated with fire, you know, the heat of the fire, you know, using the appropriate heat for, you know, what you're trying to do, you know. And I think what mantra quite often reveals to us is our tendency towards overdoing it. So when we do a mantra for a long time, if we're kind of overdoing it or trying to force it, we tend to get tired quite quickly. And the opposite is also true, that if there's not enough energy there to start with, we just sort of, again, actually, funny enough, we sort of sink and just lose interest in it. So it gives us quite a visceral, again, this is quite an embodied way of learning to work with energy, which might possibly relate to the whole, also to some of the problems people get with headache, you know, sometimes, you know. It's sort of like meditation to work, we've got to know how to apply the right energy, the right effort, and the right quality of energy. And mantra gives us a way of kind of learning about that, actually.
And it's also a way of kind of connecting on lots of different levels with a particular quality or figure.
Hmm. Right.
Cool. And I guess it depends how you do it, because again, you can do a mantra chant and you can be not present. You can be doing it in a very mechanical way and then it means nothing. But if you're sort of fully behind it and present, even if what you're experiencing is resistance or why am I doing this, or maybe it's a bit too much, if you're fully engaged with it, it's a very different experience. Yeah. I mean, I know in the Tibetan tradition, they do these like 3-month retreats where you just do mantra, chanting a particular mantra like 100,000 times, which I can't quite imagine what that would be like, actually. And you're literally just chanting the mantra from morning to night, day after day after day. I imagine it's pretty powerful, but I don't know if I could manage that personally. Yeah. Anyway, I'm thinking, why don't we end with 10 minutes of mantra chanting? And I think we will have Amitabha very much as a presence here. But I'm also thinking that, the Buddha has been a presence, but all this talk about doing the plain mantra, I think let's just do the plain Amitabha mantra. So would you want to do that, Pranyanita, or...? Okay.
Om Amideva Hree. Om Amideva Hree. Om Mani Deva Hri. 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 Mami Deva Hri. Om 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 Mami Deva Hri. Kamideva. Om Amideva Vri. 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 Om Amideva Vri.
Okay, so that brings this session to an end. And tomorrow we'll be following a similar program with the 8 o'clock meditation, 10:30 talk and practice, optional lunch lounge, and then 4 o'clock groups, 4:35 practice, discussion, possibly ritual or mantra. So hope to see you tomorrow, and have a good evening, and thanks for practicing. One of the things about coming together with a community like this is that we are all supporting each other's practice. We're not in the same room, so we don't have that tangible sense of energy that you can sometimes get in a shrine room when you're all meditating together. And yet, there's something happening, even in this virtual space, where we're supporting each other, we're connected with each other. So, thank you for your practice supporting mine.